Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from VOA Learning English, and welcome to As It Is Weekend. This is the Saturday edition of our free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington, substituting for Katie Weaver this week. It's February 6th, 2016. It was on this day in 1952 that Elizabeth II became Queen of England after her father, George VI, died. When she learned of his death and her ascension to the throne, she was in a treehouse at the Treetops Hotel near Nyeri, Kenya. Now, here's what's ahead on today's program. As we always do on Saturdays, we begin with In the News, an in-depth look at an important story of the week. Today, I'll tell you about the growing tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran and how they could affect the Middle East. And later, on American Mosaic, Dan Friedel will report on the way players in the National Football League celebrate when they score a touchdown. One player's actions are angering some fans. And later, we will present our popular series, American Stories. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. Every day here on As It Is, we bring you news from and about America and the world, and we tell you some interesting American stories. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English because we exist to help you learn everyday American English. We speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America. Now, as we do every Saturday, we begin with In the News. Tensions continue to grow between Saudi Arabia and Iran. As Iran rejoins the world community after reaching an agreement to limit its nuclear activities, some Saudis say Iran will threaten their country as it grows stronger. Tensions increased between the countries last month when Saudi Arabia executed a well-known Shiite Muslim religious leader. After the execution, protesters attacked Saudi Arabia's embassy in Tehran, the Iranian capital. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates either canceled or limited diplomatic relations with Iran. the Iranian government condemned the attack. It said more than 100 people had been arrested. But some Saudis still placed responsibility for the attack on Iranian leaders. Saudi Arabia and Iran have opposed each other for many years. Some experts say the tensions began more than 1,000 years ago, when the Muslim religion Islam split into Shiite and Sunni sects. Iran is the world's most powerful Shiite-led nation. Saudi Arabia is the strongest Sunni-led country. There are also ethnic differences between the two countries. Saudis are Arab and Iranians are Persian. The countries support opposing sides in the conflicts in Syria and Yemen. Many Saudis say if the group supported by Iran wins in either country, it would threaten the kingdom militarily and psychologically. Iran supports the Syrian government in its war against rebels and Islamic State militants. Many experts say Iran supports Houthi rebels fighting Yemen's government, which is supported by Saudi Arabia. Saudi experts say Iran's actions in Syria and Yemen are an effort to create allies in the Middle East. Jamal Khashoggi is a well-known Saudi journalist. He notes that there are Shiite militias in Iraq, and Egypt is growing closer to Russia, which also supports Syria. He says Iran is trying to control the Middle East in the same way that Germany tried to control Europe in World War II. Hamad al-Sherry is an advisor to the Saudi Minister of Foreign Affairs. He says Saudi Arabia believes its influence has declined over the past year as Iran has become more important. Now, it's time for American Mosaic. Super Bowl 50 will be played tomorrow. It is one of the most watched television programs of the year. When players score a touchdown in football, they often celebrate. But as our Dan Friedel reports, not everyone likes the celebrations.
American football is a game of great drama and theater. On Sunday, the championship game will decide who is the best and who is second best. The game will include music, noisemakers, confetti, flashing lights, and lots of action. So it may not seem out of place when football players express their enthusiasm after scoring points, called a touchdown. But lots of pregame talk has been focused on a player named Cam Newton and how he celebrates his big plays. Newton is energetic about scoring a touchdown or throwing the ball successfully to another player who then scores. That happened 45 times this season for the Carolina Panthers, so Newton celebrates a lot. He pumps his fist, he waves to the crowd, he mimics what the comic book character Clark Kent does when he is about to turn into Superman. He puts his hands to his chest and pretends to pull back his football uniform, revealing his superhero costume underneath. After a touchdown, he always gets the ball and gives it to a fan of his team, the Panthers. Some people think he really is super. He is big, strong, fast, and handsome after all. His touchdown celebrations often include a dance called the dab, which is popular among young African Americans. Newton is credited with making the move popular. The dab has caused as much controversy as the swaying hips of rock and roll star Elvis Presley when he started his career. In a game against Tennessee earlier this season, Newton scored a touchdown and broke into his dab dance. The Tennessee players were not happy with him. They ran up to him as if to challenge him to a fight. But Newton kept dancing. That prompted a Tennessee fan to write a letter to Newton that she also sent to a newspaper in North Carolina. She wrote, "We had a close-up view of your conduct in the fourth quarter. The chest puffs, the pelvic thrusts, the arrogant struts, and the in-your-face taunting of both the Titans players and fans. We saw it all." Some sports commentators started talking about the way Newton celebrates. Some say he should act like a touchdown is no big deal. Others say he should be himself and celebrate if he wants to. The debate is a reminder of what happened leading up to the Super Bowl in 1989, when Albert "Icky" Woods of the Cincinnati Bengals was doing a dance called the Icky Shuffle. Woods was a good player, but injuries shortened his career. He is best known for his dance. He did a version of the dance in a recent commercial for an insurance company. Newton is such a good player that he will be remembered for more than just a debate over his touchdown celebrations. Commentators think some white people are offended by Newton's celebrations because he is African American. After all, white athletes celebrate their touchdowns just as much, but people are not criticizing them. In a USA Today column, Nancy Armour writes, "If we're brutally honest with ourselves, the criticism of Newton comes from somewhere ugly and mean, based more on prejudice than a wish for proper decorum." Two white players known for celebrating their touchdowns in recent seasons are Aaron Rodgers and Tim Tebow. Rodgers is the star quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. Tebow was a star player in college and played in the NFL for a short time. Rodgers does a move where he thrusts his hips and pretends to put a championship belt, like the ones they award in professional boxing, around his waist. When Tebow played, he would drop to one knee and pray to God after scoring a touchdown. Both of the players have a lot of fans. Rodgers even does commercials for an insurance company that uses his celebratory move as a joke. No one really complains about their celebrations. In fact, Tebow's religious expression makes him even more appealing to some fans. When Tebow played, he wore items that referenced Bible verses. In her article about Newton, Armour talked with a professor who studied the way penalties were called on African-American football players during the 2010 season. He said one reason people are offended by these celebrations is that minorities are expected to do their jobs quietly without making a fuss. Newton says he will keep dancing no matter what people say. In a conversation with reporters earlier this week, Newton proposed a solution for those who are offended by his celebrations. "I guess you're going to have to get used to it, because I don't plan on changing." I'm Dan Friedel.
Thanks, Dan. Well, that's As It Is Weekend, the Saturday edition. We hope it has informed and entertained you, and has helped you learn everyday American English. American Stories is coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. I'll be back with you tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, American Stories. Our story today is called Athenaïs. It was written by Kate Chopin. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Athenaïs went away one morning to visit her parents, 10 miles back on the Bon Dieu River in Louisiana. She did not return in the evening, and Cazot, her husband, was worried. Cazot expressed his worries to his servant, Félicité, who served him dinner. He ate alone by the light of a coal oil lamp. Félicité stood nearby like a restless shadow.
"Only married 2 months and she has her head turned already to leave? It is not right," she said.
Cazot shrugged his shoulders. Félicité's opinion of his wife's behavior after 2 months of marriage did not matter to him. He was used to being alone and did not mind a night or two of it. Cazot stood up and walked outside. The night was beginning to deepen and gather black around the groups of trees in the yard. Far away, he could hear the sound of someone playing an accordion. Nearby, a baby was crying. Cazot's horse was waiting, saddled. He still had much farm work to do before bedtime. He did not have time to think about Athenaïs, but he felt her absence like a deep pain. Before he slept that night, Cazot was visited by an image of Athenaïs' pale young face, with its soft lips and sensual eyes. The marriage had been a mistake. He had only to look into her eyes to feel that, to sense her growing dislike of him. But the marriage could not be undone, and he was ready to make the best of it, and expected the same effort from her. These sad thoughts kept Cazot awake far into the night. The moon was shining, and its pale light reached into the room. It was still outside, with no sound except the distant notes of the accordion. Athenaïs did not return the next day, although her husband sent a message to do so through her brother, Monteclin. On the third day, Cazot prepared his horse and went himself in search of her. Athenaïs's parents, the Michets, lived in a large home owned by a trader who lived in town. The house was far too big for their use. Upstairs, the rooms were so large and empty that they were used for parties. A dance at the Michet home and a plate of Madame Michet's gumbo were pleasures not to be missed. Madame Michet was sitting on the porch outside the house. She stood up to greet Cazot. She was short and fat, with a cheery face, but she was clearly tense as Cazot arrived. Monteclin was there too, but he was not uneasy. He made no effort to hide his dislike of Cazot. "Dirty pig," he said under his breath as Cazot climbed the stairs to the porch. Monteclin disliked Cazot for refusing to lend him money long ago. Now that this man was his sister's husband, he disliked him even more. Michet and his oldest son were away. They both respected Cazot and talked highly of him. Cazot shook hands with Madame Michet, who offered him a chair. Athenaïs had shut herself in her room. "You know, nothing would do last night," Madame Michet said. "Athenaïs just had to stay for a little dance. The boys would not let their sister leave." Cazot shrugged his shoulders to show he knew nothing about last night. "Didn't Monteclin tell you we were going to keep Athenaïs?" she asked. But Monteclin had told him nothing. "And how about the night before?" asked Cazot. "And last night? Do you have dances every night?" Madame Michet laughed and told her son to go tell Athenaïs her husband had arrived. Monteclin did not move. "You know as well as I do that it is no use to tell Athenaïs anything," said Monteclin. "You and Pa have been talking to her since Monday. When Athenaïs said she was not returning to Cazot, she meant it." Two fiery red spots rose to Cazot's cheeks. What Monteclin said was true. Upon arriving home, Athenaïs had announced she was there to stay. It was difficult for her to understand why she had married. Girls were just expected to get married. And she did like Cazot. Monteclin had asked Athenaïs to explain herself. He had asked her if Cazot abused her or if he drank too much. "No," Athenaïs had said. "It is just being married that I hate. I do not like being Mrs. Cazot. I want to be Athenaïs Michet again. I do not like living with a man, all his clothing everywhere, and his ugly bare feet." At the time, Monteclin had been sorry his sister had no serious evidence to use against Cazot. And now there was Cazot himself looking like he wanted to hit Monteclin. Cazot stood up and went inside the house to his wife's room. "Athenaïs, get ready," he said quietly. "It is late, and we do not have time to lose." Athenaïs was not prepared for his calm request. She felt a sense of hopelessness about continuing to rebel against the idea of marriage. She gathered her hat and gloves. Then she walked downstairs past her brother and mother, got on her horse, and rode away. Cazot followed behind her. It was late when they reached home. Cazot once more ate dinner alone. Athenaïs sat in her room crying. Athenaïs's parents had hoped that marriage would bring a sense of responsibility so deeply lacking in her character. No one could understand why she so hated her role as wife. Cazot had never spoken angrily to her, or called her names, or failed to give her everything she wanted. His main offense seemed to be that he loved her, and Athenaïs was not a woman to be loved against her will. At breakfast, Athenaïs complained to her husband. "Why did you have to marry me when there were so many other girls to choose from?" she asked. "And it is strange that if you hate my brother so much, why would you marry his sister?" "I do not know what any of them have to do with it," Cazot said. "I married you because I loved you.
I guess I was fooled to think I could make you happy. I do not know what else to do but make the best of a bad deal and shake hands over it. It now seemed to Athenaïs that her brother was the only friend left to her in the world. Her parents had turned from her, and her friends laughed at her. But Monteclin had an idea for securing his sister's freedom. After some thought, Athenaïs agreed to his plan. The next morning, Cazot woke up to find his wife was gone. She had packed her belongings and left in the night. Cazot felt a terrible sense of loss. It was not new. He had felt it for weeks. He realized he had missed his chance for happiness. He could not think of loving any other woman, and could not imagine Athenaïs ever caring for him. He wrote her a letter stating that he did not want her back unless she returned of her own free will. Athenaïs had escaped to the big city of New Orleans. She was staying at a private hotel that Monteclin had chosen and paid to rent for a month. A woman named Sylvie owned the hotel and took good care of Athenaïs. Athenaïs soon became friends with Mr. Gouvernail, who was also staying at the hotel. This friendship helped her feel less lonely about missing her family. But Mr. Gouvernail soon started to fall in love with Athenaïs. He knew she was uninformed, unsatisfied, and strong-willed, but he also suspected that she loved her husband, although she did not know it. Bitter as this belief was, he accepted it. Athenaïs's last week in the city was coming to an end. She had not found a job and was too homesick to stay any longer. Also, she had not been feeling well. She complained in detail about her sickness to Sylvie. Sylvie was very wise, and Athenaïs was very stupid. Sylvie very calmly explained to Athenaïs that she was feeling sick because she was pregnant. Athenaïs sat very still for a long time thinking about this new information. Her whole being was overcome with a wave of happiness. Then she stood up, ready to take action. She had to tell her mother, and Cazot. As she thought of him, a whole new sense of life swept over her. She could not wait to return to him. The next day, Athenaïs spent traveling home. When she arrived at Cazot's, he lifted her out of the horse carriage, and they held each other tight. The country night was warm and still, except for a baby crying in the distance. "Listen, Cazot," said Athenaïs, "how Juliet's baby is crying. Poor darling, I wonder what is the matter with it."
You have heard the story, Athenaïs, by Kate Chopin. Your storyteller was Barbara Klein. This story was adapted and produced by Dana Demange. Listen again next week for another American story in VOA Special English.